Hello, dear heart. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
Hi, Divine Hearts. Our podcast today is with Gabriella De Mori, who is a clinical counselor and founder of Gabrielle De Mori and Co-Counseling. This podcast, I would say there is definitely a lot of wisdom for space holders, for those who are learning the business side of counseling, but also wanting to do it in our way with this non-clinical approach to counseling and understanding that we need to know our business and our capacity to work in this contemporary therapy space. Gabriella, she owns a counseling practice that is based in Cottesloe, and she thrives on supporting beautiful, sensitive, and deep feeling and busy-minded women from emotional overwhelm. Her practice works quite a lot with couples, and yeah, her inspiration is in encouraging and uprising people to learn and trust themselves, to take care of their inner world with deep grace and reverence. I find, and Gabriella knows herself to be a unique person who has a lot of understanding and capacity to describe counseling. The upcoming wānanga, if you are interested, we are starting Raranga Maiorangi, which weaves with the heavens in the beginning of February, so a few more weeks. And our next Akutoro Whānui wānanga starts in the first 2 weeks of March. Without further ado, let's dive in. Enjoy this pod. My friend Gabriella De Mori is a beautiful counsellor, and she also has her own practice based in Cottesloe and a practice in Fremantle as well. She's a boss babe, really. I asked her today because I was really interested to hear her journey as a counsellor. She specialises in sensitive women, and she also knows a lot around holding space as a counsellor and helping other counsellors and psychologists through her practice. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very honoured to be here. A little nervous, but, you know, it's good for me to step out of my comfort zone. So happy to be here.
The thing I would want to start with is what's sitting with you today?
What's been sitting with me today is just grateful for a space to honour the art of space holding, which I think you've created here, and the art of space holding and running a business, which seems like two polar opposite things. So I feel quite touched to be invited to talk about this thing that I do all day, every day, and to have some focus on it. So I think what you've created here is really special.
I really appreciate your words. It's always a little bit scary stepping into these spaces to share some of the pieces behind the scenes, but also what we're thinking as a practitioner, as a business person. So what led you to wanting to become a counsellor? What was your journey there?
So a bit of an unexpected story. I haven't always been a counsellor. I was obsessed with anthropology in my first degree and wanted to go and live and work in developing countries. And so my first career was living and working in Africa, working in women's sexual and reproductive health projects. And I thought I would do that forever and had a wild adventure, but it was challenging to be alone and to be in such unfamiliar spaces. So I came back in my mid to late 20s, had a bit of a quarter life crisis, and I took some time to ponder a lot. And I explored a whole range of different things, energy healing, meditation. And then I started to see a psychic, actually, and brought up, what should I do with myself? Because I'm having this whole career change. And she said, you're a natural psychologist. Oh, that is so different than what I have been doing. So I thought, I'll investigate that idea. And I called the local university and said, I would like to jump into your program. I've already got an undergrad and a master's degree. So if I could just swing in to finish, you know, 1 or 2 years to be a psychologist, that would be great. And the lady down the end of the phone just laughed and chuckled and was, no, that's not what's going to happen. You have to start all the way back at the beginning at undergrad. And so then I thought, well, I really want to be a therapist. I'm not attached to being a psychologist. And so I entered a beautiful counseling program instead. And it was really interesting introducing ourselves in the classes in the first year. And the teacher asks, you know, what's your name, and introduce yourself and why you're here. And my thing was, a psychic told me that I should be a therapist. And here I am. So that's how I became a counselor. And I think it really was a formalizing of natural curiosities, natural talents, and also a chance to build my confidence again in my career and my studies. Because my mum said, go back to uni, you're good at it. You'll find yourself again after this period of being completely confused. And from there, it was absolutely the right thing to do.
During that time, when you were studying, did you know what you were interested in, or was it emerging as you came along, or was it like therapy in general?
It's a really good question. I didn't have a specific vision, because I'm the type of person that just starts things and doesn't need to completely think things through. But I innately knew that I wanted to be a therapist. I realized what I knew I wanted to be, particularly when we started looking for jobs once we were graduating. And unfortunately, what was on availability was a lot of crisis work or youth work or case management or crisis centres. And I said, hang on, I want to be a therapist. And that was really important to me. And what I mean when I say that is I want to sit with someone deeply. I want to do therapy. I don't want to do crisis work. I don't want to put out fires every session. I want to deeply know someone and really, really work with them. And so I noticed in my assignments, I did have a focus a lot on relationships, on intimacy, on sex as well. And so that coloured a lot of my assignments. But I don't think I was so aware of how strong that desire to be a depth therapist was until we graduated and saw what the options were.
How would you describe a depth therapist to those who don't know what that means?
Such a great question. There's so many types of counseling, psychology, modalities, ways of supporting people. And how I would describe it is, at first, I think it's easier to describe what I don't think it is. So some agencies or counselors may be oriented towards 3 to 6 sessions, solution focused, cognitive only approaches, or be concerned with just keeping you stable enough to get you back to employment and not really opening the box or the depth of who you are. Nothing wrong with those approaches. It's just not who I am. I like to be able to hold space for the breadth and depth of people and hold space for all of whom they are, as well as give them the literal space to be able to come frequently for as long as they want, ongoing. And that is a big intentional direction of wanting to work in private practice. So I don't believe if you start with someone and you know you have 3 sessions that you can do any depth work. So by creating the space where clients can come long term, it already sets up the availability for us to be like, there is no rush here. I don't have to refine what we talk about to one aspect of you that we have to focus on to get you back to functioning. We can go to your childhood. We can go to all parts of you. We can do abstract work. We can go to your inner child. We can do mindful self-inquiry. So I would say the container I hold or offer is broad. And I'm personally inspired and curious by truly deeply knowing someone. And that's what keeps me feeling fulfilled to provide that for others. Also, it's what provides enjoyment for myself. And often you don't really know who someone is or what they want or what they need or what their traumas are until many sessions later. And so I feel like if I was to work in a limited session capacity, I wouldn't really truly get to know that person, and perhaps they wouldn't have the opportunity to know themselves either.
I really agree. I was actually surprised by that when I started studying counseling, like how much the crisis factor is. I mean, it's a whole thing I could go into, but it doesn't make sense in so many ways in terms of the way that the system's set up and the capacity and mindset and view of counseling, of how much help it can be. And I came from a life coaching background, so I was bringing that in and going, what is going on here? Like, why are we sending these counselors into always crisis situations when it should be more of a team aspect? As you began doing counseling, did you go straight into private practice?
No. I thought I hit the jackpot with an agency job, and I was actually one of the few counselors from my cohort who got a job. So I thought, oh, okay, I've nailed it. How exciting. I actually got a job. And many of them didn't get a job and never got a job. But what I walked into was the exact opposite of where I wanted to be, where I needed to be, and what would help me flourish. And it was an agency with a limited number of sessions. It was the type of agency where you met the first person for the first call, another person for the assessment, another person for your therapist, another person for this. And when your time was up, you were out of the train and we just move on and refer you on somewhere else and your time here is done. And it was a free service. So, of course, I understand the limitations there. So that experience, I really, really struggled, not only as a human, but as a therapist. And I had this clinical lead supervisor who just always looked at me like I was a bit strange. And it was very psychology oriented. They used psychology templates, psychology language, psychology formulation, all of these things we never focused on in our counseling degree. And I remember having the first, what do you call those meetings that you have to have where they like review your performance or performance review? Yeah. So because I've been mainly self-employed my whole life, a lot of this employee stuff was also completely familiar to me. And she was like, yeah, I just can see you as like a Jewish psychotherapist in New York with like this exposed brick office and these dark, broody rooms. And I was like, okay, is this what's meant to happen in a performance review? I don't understand what's happening here. And she was like, yeah, you're a real maverick, aren't you? And I was like, is that a cowboy? Like, I don't even know what this word is. So I came out of that meeting feeling very confused and Googled what is a maverick and realized it was someone that does things in an unorthodox way, someone who creates their own path, someone who doesn't really like to follow rules or likes the structures. And I think it was a great compliment that she thought I could be a Jewish psychotherapist, but it did not fit into the model that I was in. And all of those things that I didn't like about that place, including the overhead fluorescent lights and the counseling rooms with no natural windows and a lot of other sensory things I could rant about, really informed how I designed my private practice, which I went into a year or two later.
I'm going to dig into the private practice thing because I think that it's something that both as counselors, but even for the trainees going through bodywork training up with Toro Whanui, that thought of jumping out on your own is so terrifying. So obviously it was apparent that you didn't fit there. You may have known from observing other practices that you didn't fit there. How did you get the guts to jump into private practice?
Yeah, guts or necessity is an interesting combination. But I actually left that job and went back to manage a beautiful psychology practice that was my job while I was at uni. I just loved being there. I loved the therapist. I loved the room. I loved soaking up all the information from these incredible therapists. So I got to see what private practice was like. But as a counselor, it wasn't going to work at that practice because it was psychology focused. So slowly, slowly, I took on a half day a week at that practice. I rented a room. And no, actually, I think the reason why I started my practice, I remember now, is I had a very bossy, fabulous classmate who called me one day while I was managing this practice and said, Gabriella, I've got this person that needs to see you for counseling. I said, honey, like, fine, but I don't know what to do. She's like, well, you have to open your private practice because they need to see you and I will only send them to you. So that's actually how I was forced to start my own private practice. And I think I rented the room on a Sunday and charged $30 or something ridiculous. And my first client ever was a couple, which is quite unique. And from there, my confidence grew and I set the intention to start my own business and start marketing because I had such a beautiful time working in that way and it felt really in alignment and it was inspiring to me.
That's beautiful. I think that's always a good sign when people are just asking you. I don't think I'm very good at making myself do things that I don't want to do. So if I know there's a need, there's already someone that would want that. That's how I find motivation. So do you want to say anything about working with couples at all? Seeing as your first clients were a couple, for me, I don't feel at all like a expert at working with couples. I feel like it's very clunky at women if I do. So I just wonder if there's anything to say.
Couples is hard work. Couples is either the best work you will do or the hardest sessions you will do. And it's very different to an individual session. You are constantly dancing between two people, two people's goals, two people's needs, two people's nervous systems and triggers and upset. You have to be quite masterful at it. When a couple really wants to be there and they're genuinely curious and they're not in a crisis themselves, usually the whole session and the experience goes beautifully. But often, unfortunately, couples come in when one person has threatened separation and the other person says, fine, I'll finally go to counseling, even though they don't want to be there and they have been avoiding this for 5 years. So it's about the intention of the couple in terms of how well the session goes. But it is such an honor to see couples' patterns play out and hold space vulnerably for them in the moment, because they get triggered in session. They hurt each other in session. They get scared of each other in session. They side with me or themselves against me in session. And so what happens outside the room also happens inside the room. So you have to be able to hold space for all of that while providing tools and strategies to pull together all the complexity of all the things that is happening and give them something in some ways that's quite contained for them to work through in between sessions.
Were you saying that your focus now is more sensitive woman? What inspires you about that area? So I don't know, I just want to give a little bit of background to people who may not know. Counselors, we will typically have a bit of a specialization, but I am more of a generalist in a way. There's a commonality for me. I prefer, similar to Gabriella, to work with people who want to be there. I'm happy to do crisis things, but there's a certain energetic of people who get called in to do the type of work we do, I would say, where you are having that ongoing relationship. Well, at least the clients that I'm seeing, they're wanting a different life and are willing to explore that in some way, just to look at what that may be rather than needing to get out of a situation in a way. That's not always the case either. Lots of people are also in crisis in the moment and they can still have that energetic, I've found.
Look, we could go a few ways. I've been a couples counselor for 10 years now, and now my team, my group practice specializes in couples. We have an incredibly talented and passionate team of couples therapists. Couples counseling is a niche service because very few counselors, therapists do it. I don't even know one psychologist off the top of my head in Perth who does couples counseling. So it's quite a niche for good reason. And so this is one of our more focused areas that we're quite known for. And it's a joy to continue to offer that because you want someone great. And I really trust my team who are passionate about couples and relationships. Sensitive women for me came quite late in the game in running my solo practice. When you get into business, there's all this advice, niche down, focus, you know, talk about your niche, come up with a 30-second elevator pitch. What's your I help statement? And I hated this. I could not do this. I'm not a elevator pitch kind of gal. I still couldn't do it. If you asked me in the first 5 seconds to say, Gabriella, tell me what your business does, I'd say, let's talk for an hour and a half.
I have to send through a half page thing about my practice to someone. And do you think I could do it? I'm like, I can't do it. I don't know what to say.
It's like, here's my PhD on every thought, theory, event, you know, that has led me up to this moment in my life. Absolutely. So I would have said I'm a generalist as well. And I used to go to lots of networking and people would say, who do you work with? And I tried a range of things for many years. And sometimes I just went with people like you and me, people who want to love their inner world. I work in the non-mental health space, which I still stand by. I don't consider myself a mental health counselor or run a mental health agency. I play in a different space. But who I am naturally and who I actually really enjoy working with, I was using all these different words, you know, deeply emotional, curious about the world, busy minds, sensitive, not sensitive, you know, aware, have lots to go through, you know. And again, sometimes it's easier to describe than the opposite. I don't work well with A-type personalities or OCD type or rigidity or cognitive focused people. It is not my strong point. And so after some years of winging it through this, running a business but not having a 30-second elevator pitch, it just came, it was so in front of me that I couldn't see it. And so then it came to me sensitivity. Sensitive women have all of these things that I love to talk about. I'm sensitive. I've been sensitive my whole life. And that gave me a language to refine in as much possibility about what the niche is. But recently, I've been trialing this, instead of being highly sensitive, I've been trialing what could be another word, because no one wants to identify as highly sensitive. Everyone uses sensitive as a criticism. And so if you think about, you know, this business mission I've had to help sensitive women love their inner worlds and take over the world and be proud, it's the hardest sell ever. It's like, I don't want to go anywhere near that. So anyway, the best I've come up with recently is highly gentle, which I kind of love. It just sort of takes the criticism away from it, the shame away from it. But, you know, sensitive people are generally gentle souls. So in some ways, I'm adapting my niche as we go along because nobody likes the word.
I actually thought it was really genius, but I was like, oh, interesting. I wouldn't use that word. Then I was like, people who do feel like the world can be really challenging and overwhelming probably would relate to it, even if they wouldn't go around calling themselves that. So it's like a sort of a bit of a call card. So I did think it was a good word when you sent it through. Those who are listening, if there's something you can think of to say to them
about
some of the expectations on us as business owners or private practice owners to be all together, branding and marketing and things like that. But some of that work, like you said, around trying to refine ourselves, we can hold really tightly and it might not be necessary.
Well, it's an interesting thing because you start a private practice because you want to be a therapist and you want to do work. And then you think, oh, okay, how do I get people through the door? Oh, okay, I have to do marketing. Oh, what is that? How do I do that? So you inadvertently open yourself up to many tabs and many hats that no one taught you at uni. You didn't study marketing for 3 years. You didn't study accounting. You didn't study networking. You studied to be a therapist. So it's a very interesting space to be thrown into. And I think most of us have coaches. Most of us have had to spend thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in coaching to learn the business side of things. I think if I was someone who said, I like working with high achieving corporate women with anxiety, I probably wouldn't have needed as much business coaching because it's so clear and to the point. But when you want to fight for depth and complexity and shuck those marketing straitjackets that they try and put you into, you have to find different ways to continue to explain who you are. As you say, clients tend to find you. And so the best way is recommendations, because if you see a client, they're going to tell their friend, oh, you should go see Gabriella, Gabriella. She's so this, da, 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 da. And that person innately knows who will be a good fit for you. But as you go along, you first need clients to share your experience with so that they can go out. But often clients don't want to share their therapist with their friends, or they don't want to tell their friends they're seeing someone, or they don't want to talk about the fact they're going for counseling. And so a big part of what I see is one of the challenges of marketing a counseling business is people don't want to be associated with you. No one wants to comment on your post, oh, that was so me in our session. No one wants to write a Google review because it identifies them as a client and it's linked to their email. Nobody wants to share your post because they don't want to be associated. It's this secret world sometimes. It's not like, hey, here's my plumber's number, 5-star reviews. You need to go see my plumber. It's very private. It's very personal. And I wish that I could be the type of therapist that never has a website and people just get her mobile number and she's in some secret suburb in White Gum Valley and you turn up and there's no sign and you're under a tree. Magically, you know, and that's how you find all the great healers in White Gum Valley. You're on these escapades of someone said this and she's really crazy, but she's really good. And, you know, don't worry about her 15 cats, but go into the basement and she'll give you a beautiful healing session. And you follow these trails and you're like, great, I can do this. And I wish I was that therapist. I wish I existed in an orbit of just text message recommendations. However, I think like most of us, we've had to focus on marketing and try and communicate who we are, what we do, not only to help people know us, but also because I'm sure it's the same for you. We want to work with people that we want to work with so that we can be our best. We get the best out of the clients and we don't have this misalignment with who walks through the door and who you want to be and what you can offer, because that never goes well, both for yourself or the client. And so a big part of marketing a counseling business is actually educating the client or potential client, not only on all of their frequently asked questions, all of their confusion around the mental health industry and who to go and where to go.
I was chuckling because when I first started, I tried sharing a space for a while and I did not like sharing with other therapists. I'm not good at it. So I was actually doing outdoor sessions for a while under trees and beside Jenilup and Point Walter. So I was like, oh, that was me, where I was like, look for the surf kayak and then turn right. I was really weirdly lucky. Like, I think I only had to cancel 3 times ever. Oh, word lady, there was a thunderstorm. She had to bring a jacket. So random. Lifetime ago. I love your branding. I think it's so beautiful. And it really does speak to who you are. I agree with what you're saying there. What are some of the frequently asked questions that your clients tend to have around therapy or those sorts of things that you would want to say to them?
I could go on and on. How many sessions will I need? What is the cost? Are there rebates? What's the difference between you and a psychologist? What do I do if I want to come for couples counseling and my partner doesn't? I'm nervous, but I want to be there, but I'm too shy to come. How can you help me? Do I need to call my GP? Can I just DM this girl off Instagram? The thousands of questions people have, but it's also educating them about you so that you can, when that person walks through the door, you're like, nailed it. And I must say, for all of my rants about marketing and how hard it is, 99% of the time someone walks through my door, I think, nailed it. And we have a beautiful, magical time together. There is many barriers a person has to overcome to get into a counseling room. The first is they have to notice themselves enough that they're having some problems. They have to allow themselves space to say, okay, I'm having some challenges in these areas. That can take someone 15 years. Then they have to start to consider, okay, maybe I'll go and see someone. Then they meet the smorgasbord of options and people stay in overwhelm there for days, months, years. Then they have to be brave enough to send an inquiry, and then they have to be even brave enough to actually book and turn up. Okay, lots of cancellations and avoidance happens throughout this whole journey. Then they come and sit in front of you and they go, so what do we do here? And there's a lot of education, I would say, at all stages of that. And I'm particularly passionate about helping people match with the right therapist. And I have business coaches and business mentors tell me all the time, Gabriella, you spend way too much time trying to help people who inquire with you get the best match therapist. Just send them the booking link or send them away. And I was like, no, you know, this is part of the service that I want to do. If I'm not the right person for them, I will generally try and recommend somewhere or spend a detailed amount of time matching them with one of our team of therapists. So I honor the confusion, the vulnerability, the courage that it takes to come, and always inspiring women to and couples to just come. It's fun and it's not that scary, but it takes a long time to help them to understand that. I find younger people are more open to the process. They're much more comfortable. They're happy to talk to their friends about it. They're more proactive. They have a language around mental health. You know, TikTok, they teach me about things. So, you know, and often TikTok's not right, but there is a language, there is a familiarity. And so getting one of those types of young people into a room, the barriers aren't as big. But I would say there's many, many ways that one can avoid or turn away from care, because it can simply be too overwhelming to figure out.
That was interesting to me. I'm not thinking about it in the same way, because I have a number of different hats, if that makes sense, because I'm taking like life coaching and then healing and all these different things.
I think a lot of the resistance is before you get to meet them. Once they send an inquiry or book in, you are home and hosed. But that journey for someone to do that can take 15 years. Or it can be people like me. Oh, great. You think I should go see this lady under a tree who's from New Zealand? Brilliant. Oh, there, I'll sunscreen. And it, you know, my pathway is 6 seconds because I'm a curious person. But for many people, it's many years.
Oh my God, I have so many directions I could go in. I wanted to ask about how you do hold that emotional space when you are going through your own shit. I know that can be really challenging for me at times. Not always. Sometimes it's really healing to be seeing other people who are going through things. You said sometimes that we have a certain emotional capacity in a week or, yeah, but if it escalates beyond that.
Interesting question, because I find that quite easy in a way, and I've never tried to work full time. So I have only ever seen clients, usually I see clients for 4 days a week, 5 to 6 clients. And I did that for many years. Now, because I run the business, I've dropped it down to 3 days and 5 clients. So I've never worked full time. And because I know I would really struggle with that. I've also learned as a counselor, and this is one of the interesting conundrums of identifying as a highly sensitive person, is I have also learned I'm incredibly tough. And so I can be falling apart, crying, having my own life journey, and very rarely take a day off work. I almost have to be dying to take a day off work. I am tough as guts. And that's credit to my own journey of caring for myself, that I know how to regulate in the morning. I know what I need to do in the morning. I know how to care for myself. And I've learned a lot of that through my own brilliant therapists. So I don't find that particularly challenging. The other thing as a private practice owner one has to lean into or master, which may or may not be difficult, is boundaries. No, I can't see you on Saturday. No, I don't adjust my time. No, the session has to end. No, I only work these days. And so I've had to be pretty meticulous about that, particularly as in the early days, I was subleasing rooms. And so you're only available in these days. So you can't go outside of those boundaries. But it would also be true that at the end of the day, I'm not going to a dinner party with 15 people. My lifestyle has to be after work quietness. My lifestyle before work, I walk a lot. I walk by the water a lot. I need my mornings to prepare. I need my quiet evenings to decompress. So we may be seeing clients for 20 hours a week, but actually the time I'm spending to prepare and nurture and integrate and think about those clients goes well beyond that time. So softness and strength, as I say, I'm a weird combination of two things, but my clients, I don't find stressful to show up for either when I'm having a particularly hard time. I think I just think in my brain, oh, aren't we all in this together?
I'm similar in that I very rarely would cancel, but occasionally something will knock me out. And yeah, maybe every few years or something where I just hit this space where I get almost compassion fatigue, and then I'll cut back a lot when I get to that space. But yeah, in the day-to-day, even when I had COVID and my brain was struggling to go, but I'm like, I've got COVID. Cancel your sessions. But I'm so used to showing up. So you don't have to answer this question, but I guess I'm curious around seeing couples and navigating relationship things as well. How has that been on your journey?
I think it informs me bringing a really human and relatable approach to couples counseling, which I also bring to being an individual. There is no roadmap. There is no 10-point handout that I can bring in from my folder that will solve this. No two relationships are the same. And so if I struggle in my own relationships, then I have to deal with the imposter syndrome sometimes of showing up as a couples therapist. But I consistently take I think there's two approaches therapists can take. One is that they think they're an expert and they're there to deliver the evidence, the guidance, the solutions, and, oh, here's what you need to do because of this bite. And I've worked really hard to consider myself actually more as a facilitator, not as an expert or a guru. And so that informs how I show up, and that takes the pressure off me if I'm having troubles in relationships to need to think of myself as an expert when I show up for couples as well. Some couples, I think in my head, also at times I've been single. Wow. It's okay to be single. this is very distressing to see. Sometimes I come away from sessions thinking, that was the most beautiful thing. I hope I find that one day soon. And so I would say couples work is more of an emotional roller coaster, but I think I'm so hyper-focused in session. I'm able to tune out for whatever's going on in my personal life, be relatable, and just do the best we can with two different puzzle pieces of humans who are trying to relate and try and keep perfectionism in relationships out of the room, which can be challenging, but I try and rely myself on them.
How do you feel afterwards? I'm just curious, because I feel like in a session, I'm so present. Like I don't even think about anything in my life. I mean, things will be ticking together, but then sometimes afterwards I'll have things come up.
Or imposter syndrome.
Yeah, imposter syndrome or doubts or anything. It doesn't have to just be couples, but you know, with anyone, if things come up afterwards.
I like this phrase that if you think you know it all, it's time to retire. And again, that speaks to me not being the expert. Actually, when I interview staff, if they think they're the expert, I don't buy them. I don't think anyone has the answers. And so when I'm more grounded in my capabilities, I can honour that and think, just do my best. Of course, I've spent 10 years spending probably hundreds of thousands of dollars in professional development, in courses, in training, in absolutely advancing my skills. A master's degree in counselling I saw as a certificate. That was the starting point. I've invested thousands of dollars in one-to-one supervision. Like the level of input that goes into this body that I am, or this instrument that I am, is not easy. And when I'm able to remind myself of that, I can have a little bit more confidence. Something that also helps me with imposter syndrome is thinking, well, the whole world hasn't figured out mental health. Otherwise, we'd all solve every mental health problem. So me in my 1 hour in the one brain that I have, no, I didn't solve it for that person today or in the last six sessions. However, there is no rule book and I have to do my best with the gray areas, because if there was a clear cut rule book, we would all follow the rule book and none of us would have problems about anything. So I think to be a counselor, you have to have a love of the gray areas. And also that is incredibly hard. And I think you're more prone to having imposter syndrome thoughts or beliefs, because in some ways it's very hard to have a measuring stick or a yardstick about how well you're doing. Some sessions I feel like all I did was listen, and I get an email from the client saying, thank you so much for deeply hearing. And I might have left that session thinking, oh, I didn't make time for, you know, strategies or reflection or doing anything. And sometimes I might just listen and a client emails me or tells me the next session, yes, that just wasn't really helpful. Like what I need is ABCD. So no two client is the same either, even if I do the exact same thing. Some people love my IFS parts, where my mindful self-inquiry. Someone go, okay, not that again. Can we just go back to doing what we usually do? So you have to hold space for yourself as a counselor in the waters that, or the waves that pretty consistently come about. Do I know what I'm doing? Am I good enough? And ethically, am I the right therapist for this person? That is one issue that you have to be really mindful of. That is different from, I feel overwhelmed. I'm not sure where we're going with this, but I'm still the right therapist for that person. And really good supervision can help you differentiate between when you're out of your scope and when you're doing a good enough job. It's just that this client has complexity, has a lot going on, and you have to, again, broaden your container to hold the space for them, even if you don't know where you are going.
I was going to say something random that popped in. I was cracking up. I ran a supervision call yesterday. I was in a very like directive, bossy energy, really digging in. And I was just laughing. So funny, because I'm the same person, right? And some days I'm more of a healing energy and like, I'll listen to what's going on. And other times I'm like, right, let's cut through this. And it's even me as a person changes who I am. And so then that means we can adapt to people more than I think sometimes in school we're taught about, oh, this ethical decision of who people are. But there is a right person. Like if someone finds their right counselor, their right therapist, like they are going to expand so much. It is often, even when things look super dire, it is often only really small tweaks of in mindset or just choices that you make or decisions internally, even though to get to those small tweaks, and I'm doing air quotes, it's actually like a hell of a lot of work. And to even uncover what those are and for us to mirror back what that is. But often no one knows what those things are. But once we find them, they can be small tweaks.
Yeah, absolutely. Holding space for enormous darkness or grief that won't shift is hard work. I like to step outside of ourselves and just honor what we do as space holders. A lot of people tell me, Gabrielle, I couldn't do what you do for 5 minutes. And it's true, because what we do is hard, even though we may find it challenging. I think two things I just also want to add is managing our own expectations. If someone has had negative beliefs for 15 years, or they're separating from a 20-year marriage, or they had trauma 30 years ago that continues to be touched on, or they've been depressed for 18 months, I think we're all at risk of feeling the need to fix and get people out of things as soon as we can. And I just like, in some ways, to remind myself and to anybody listening, is that there's so much of the human experience, you know, heartbreak and grief, I think, are two particular ones that are important. That it doesn't matter how good I am, I cannot fix this heartbreak for you 6 days after your husband left. I cannot. And you know what is the hardest sell? Is to sit with a client and go, suffering is part of life, and I do not have the handout to give you that is going to make this better anytime. You know, you have to try and instill hope. However, what we can do in this space, infertility is a really hard space that I work in at times. I can't fix it. Loneliness, not finding relationships, parents who live overseas and you're incredibly homesick. I cannot literally fix those things. It does not matter how much of a brilliant therapist I am. But yet you are presented with, please help me, please fix my distress, please get me out of this as soon as possible. And I think that is really hard for us to put the expectation on ourselves to bring someone out of a very normal human experience. I think if someone's nervous system has been dysregulated for 20 years, of course there is pressure on us. Of course there is a sense of urgency. Of course there is, please get me out of this state now. And I think it's challenging to navigate that as a therapist, while also knowing that we always have to strike the balance between at times giving grounding tools and strategies and things that will help that person right now to have enough containment to then go and do the longer term work or the harder work. And so we always have to make that dance between what we can do with people. The last thing I just want to say on imposter syndrome is often when I walk away from not feeling like I'm a good therapist, it's actually some transference or something that I can learn from a client. Because if I have 6 clients or 15 clients that week and, well, I did a good job and someone takes me down, what is it about what's going on for them that has made me feel like that? What is it about that client that has knocked me off my center? And being curious about that and being curious about the personality structures of the client or their level of expectation on you, or that they may never be. That you consistently get this feeling with clients that you don't appease them, and pondering, how do they show up in other parts of life like this? Do other people in their life feel like this? Are they putting too much responsibility on me as a therapist and not putting enough accountability on themselves as the client? Is this person talking down to me? Is this person belittling me subconsciously? I get that with a lot of certain clients and couples, actually. So taking those sessions and being curious about why in particular that client has taken my confidence down actually gives more juice. And again, brilliant supervision can help you sort over those panics and worries and help you see that you're feeling and taking on experiences and expectations of the clients.
And then with that aspect of managing other therapists, how has that journey been? What led you into that?
My practice naturally grew in that I had more inquiries than I could see. So it was a very organic process to try and find other heart-centered and like-minded therapists to join me and to join my mission and to do counseling and the support around counseling in a very similar way to myself. So it has been an enormous journey, again, of adding more hats Now I mentor people. Now I have to understand contracts and obligations and invoicing. And so the hats as a business owner continue to grow, but I can't share my mission with enough people because as counselors, you know, we have this emotional capacity. We may have 5 days in the week we're able to see clients that we have time. But as a space holder, and I think as a depth space holder, we can't do 40 hours a week of client work. So we have to contain ourselves. And I think this is something important in the industry. We should note that emotionally there is a cap. There is a ceiling on us in doing this special work and doing it well. Some other types of therapists can do 10 sessions in a day. Some of them can work 50 hours a week. Hats off to them. But for many people who I think particularly work in a heart-centered way or in a body-oriented way or in a depth way are going to find that you give so much of yourself, you're so present, you are going to have time capacity on how many clients you can support. So it was a natural flow to find beautiful, like-minded people who also wanted to work in private practice and understood the difference of what we offer at GDM, we nickname it. And it's been lots of fun, lots of hard, boring stuff in the back end that I haven't enjoyed. Lots of hats I would like to delegate, lots of things I'm proud of leaning into, but I'm proud that we can offer more. And I like to try and think of myself as having threads through my therapist and going to the clients, and that that mission of what I'm trying to achieve goes through them when you have the right team members.
With having different practitioners, if there were other people who were thinking of going into that space of like holding space for different therapists, and like what would you recommend now? Because I know it's been a big journey. What would you say to yourself when you're starting?
One of the first things that comes up is that it is a model for expanding your business, but it doesn't have to be the model. Every model of a business comes with pros and cons. I think if you consider the types of roles and tasks that is going to require you to grow a private practice, and if you're interested in that, and if that suits you, then go for it. You have to be interested enough in business on its own to grow and scale, because what you end up doing is spending a lot of time growing a business, looking at systems and processes, looking at reminder email templates, you know, accounting, GST, contracts, dealing with challenging staff, managing team member expectations. You have to try and consider what that will be like and just decide if that's for you or not, and or if you can afford to outsource that with a practice manager. But for most of us in a small business, although we'd love to hire the HR person and the IT guy and the gardener and the cleaner and the marketing manager, we would love to, but we can't, which is why we end up wearing so many hats. So there's no right or wrong. It absolutely expands your reach, which is beautiful. When you have beautiful practitioners, you love to interact with them and you feel like you've met sort of your like soul work family. But I would say it's not the only way to go, and you don't have to do it if you're growing your caseload and you can't see clients. I would just say it's a personal choice.
For a course I was running recently, I wrote down all the roles that I do play that would be jobs. Like, and I was like, holy, but yeah, I just wondered if there would be any hints about switching between those roles, because I find that code shifting a bit challenging at times. But yeah, do you have any hints for people in the space?
No strategy for that. I'm someone that can do a broad range of things all at the same time. Every few weeks, I write the same map. Okay, on Tuesdays, I'm going to do content breaks. On Fridays, I've done this 10,000 times. I'm going to really stick to this in one class. However, literally yesterday, for example, I just finished a call from my accountant talking about something GST. One of my team members called because she was near tears about something. My dad turned up because I asked him to buy me something for the office to deliver it. And my admin girl yelled out some question. And I was like, whoa, Nelly. So as much as we can plan, in that 30 seconds, I had four different things going on, which I could handle all of them, but I don't know how much we can stick things in structure. I think I could absolutely do with some structure and not try and do everything at once. But the reality is you are going to have to wear many hats. You have to love it. You have to be curious about all of these things. Otherwise, you will be an employee and you will love it and you will clock off and it will be the best thing for you. And that is a wonderful model for many, many people. However, if you like to make your life difficult and have lots of lists running through your brain every time you try and go to sleep or have a Sunday off, open a business.
I really agree with you. And I really like the acknowledgement that you have to love business as well. I do love it. And I like a healthy challenge. I like figuring things out. And I wonder what happens if I tweak that or if I do that. But I also get that it's not for everyone. And I feel like when I first stepped into the space, there wasn't enough chat on that. So I like the message. I feel like you've succinctly put things together.
I'm going to tell two stories because I love to tell stories. I was at a networking event a few weeks ago. Three people, me, a new business owner, and a nurse. And the new business owner was talking about how hard it was for her to start her own business and have the responsibility to pay for herself. And the nurse says, oh my God, I could never do that. I could just never, oh my God, worry about paying my own salary. Hats off to you. And then she looked at me and said, people, one person, there's like eight people on your payroll. I got my accountant. I got my assistant. I've got my, it's like, there's a lot of mouths to feed. I don't know how I got here, but here I am. So you have to take on a lot of responsibility while also being the leader and taking charge and doing the strategic CEO things, as well as, okay, Gab, the Wi-Fi is broken. Can you call Vodafone? All right, put the strategy down. I'm calling Vodafone because the Wi-Fi is down.
In your name.
In my name. And I'm the only one that could call because I have to, I don't know, remember some three-digit code that I never do when I call Vodafone. The other thing that has made it much easier for me to do that a lot of people don't have is I come from a family of business owners and entrepreneurs, and so I have inbuilt free business mentors in my life. And I come from a family where my mum and dad never got in our way to tell us what we should do, what we should be. I think there were high expectations of whatever you do it to the best of your ability, but it was never prescriptive of what we had to do. And as such, the four of us have all gone into completely different things, and I would like to say we're all successful in our own way. So I have that advantage of growing up in a family where they never say, you can't do that, who'll pay for that, and you should just get a job. I've never had to deal with that. And I have the support when I can call my mom or my sister and say, how would you handle this challenge? And they are there. So I have an advantage. My sister, who ran a business many, many years ago, she's 5 years younger than me, but has always run a business, once said to me when I was thinking about opening something, said, Gabriella, if you want to do this, I'd like you to think about if this business gets burnt to the ground and everybody robs you and you lose everything, you will build that business again. And she had been through, not those exact examples, but some business experiences that burnt her to the ground in a round of way, in a range of ways, and she rebuilt. And I always remember that. And so it's not just this easy thing of register your business name and start an Instagram and there'll be this flood of referrals through the door. You have to be so committed to make this work, I think, particularly in the counseling space. You want to make sure you've got enough grit, enough guts, enough resilience, enough tenacity, enough confidence to brave the visibility challenges that come with selling yourself, being online, showing your face online. A joke about my endless nightmares that, you know, my registration body is going to email me one day like, hi, Gabriella, there's been a report that you made a Beyonce reference in your weekly newsletter and we're taking away your registration. And I think that will happen to me because Beyonce is like a theme in most of my things, but towing the line constantly of trying to be creative while also maintaining my professional registration, there's a lot of gray areas there. So I think there's a lot to consider. And I see a lot in Facebook groups, people saying, I'm thinking of starting my own business. How do you know when you're ready as a counselor? And I never take the time to write it because I could write a PhD. But if you're considering going into private practice, one thing is how prepared you are as a therapist to do this on your own, in a room by yourself, at 6 o'clock at night where someone can tell you anything and everything and you have to be able to handle it. But the business nous that you are going to need is very different than how ready you are as a practitioner to take on a private practice. But because that would be the world's longest comment, you never see me commenting on it in Facebook groups. So where do I start?
Yeah.
Come to my TED talk.
Yeah.
I need more detail. Yeah. Like, what are you thinking? Where is it coming from? Thank you so much for your generosity today. It's been really beautiful to hear everything you've synthesized about your practice and your business and your heart. I really value that. And I've admired you for ages, but it's cool to hear the ins and outs as well. It's like what's sitting with you right now. Is there anything else on your heart to share as we wind down?
I think my general message to women or sensitive women or gentle women is to trust that you can do most things that you want to. And I hope in some way I can show that you can be sensitive and a business owner. You can be sensitive and show up. You can be sensitive and go after your dreams. You can be sensitive and live outside your comfort zone. And my hope in some way, whether you want to run a business or you want to share your poetry online or sell your art at a market, whatever you want to do as a unique person in this world, just try to remember that it's important that you're braver than you think you are and that the world needs your magic. And so if I can inspire one sensitive person to unmask or come out of the shadows and connect with their unique magic and know, hey, I'm here for a reason. I have this unique thing to offer. You don't have to be a CEO, but I would like sensitive women to connect to their hearts, their dreams, and whatever that is. And have a little sass and a little bit of spunk and have a little bit of fun as well.
Thank you, Gabriella.